KCSU-FM Stanford, welcome to another edition of Hearsay Culture. My name is Dave Levine. I'm an associate professor at Elon University School of Law, as well as an affiliate scholar at the Center for Internet and Society at Stanford Law School. Thank you for joining me today on the show. Today I'm excited to have on author Gabriella Coleman, author of the new book Coding Freedom, The Ethics and Aesthetics of Hacking. Gabriella has done a really fascinating job here taking a look at the hacker community. Hacker, the name itself, actually being a controversial one and one that we'll talk about a little bit. But in Gabriella's work, she has done something that heretofore has not been done. She has treated the hacking community from an anthropological perspective and studied it by going into the community itself. Now, the way I'm describing this, it sounds like we're studying a rare animal or a pack of wolves. But what in fact Gabriella has done and did over the course of several years is immerse herself in the community, East Coast and West Coast, even some international work, and became everything from a volunteer at the Electronic Frontier Foundation to someone sitting at dinners talking to people in the community to really get a sense of what that community is. What are their values? What are their mores? What are the demographics of the community? What makes them tick? And she specifically focused on the community around the open source world, the world that was founded in large measure by Richard Stallman but has developed since then. And so she dug deep into the world of coding and free software and open source and a lot of the issues that we've discussed on this show really from since its inception. And so Gabriella comes at this as an anthropological study, but then in some ways really became very much a part of that community. And in fact, in discussions that Gabrielle and I have had prior to the interview, we know a lot of people in common, and in fact I think we'll have an interesting discussion from that perspective as well. And so the book, which has been published by Princeton University Press, takes a close look at this community. There's a lot of really interesting information, not only with regard to the community itself, but insights from someone who was on the outside and went on the inside, but again was taking this from an academic perspective about where that community is and where it stands and where it's headed. And so we're going to have a pretty wide-ranging discussion today of a number of issues around that community aside from its demographics. And I'm going to talk to Gabriella a bit on issues ranging from transparency within that community to intellectual property to Richard Stallman himself. So I'm very excited to have Gabriella on. She is the Wolf Chair in Scientific and Technological Literacy in the Department of Art, History, and Communication Studies at McGill University. She is joining us from her office at McGill via Skype. We are recording the show on February 5th for airing February 7th. And I thank Gabriella for joining us today on Hearsay Culture. Thanks so much for being here.
Oh, it's my pleasure.
So, Gabriella, let me start off particularly in your case, given how you put together this book and all the work that you did over a course of several years to write it, tell us a bit about how you became interested in diving this deep into the hacker community.
So when I went to graduate school back in the late 90s, I was going to do a very traditional anthropology project on religious healing in Guyana. But I had always been interested in the question of patents and medicine and access. This is something I just followed on the side politically. And then one day a friend who knew about this interest, basically pulled me aside, sat me down and said, look, if you're really interested in this question of access and thinking about new models for access, you really should learn about this license called the copyleft, which is a class of licenses invented by these free software hackers that mandate access, not restriction. It works in, almost the opposite fashion of copyright. And, I was really taken aback. I was taken aback for two reasons. First of all, at the time, it was fully operational, the world of free software in a kind of technical sense as well as in a legal sense. People were using these licenses on software that was running the internet. And I was pretty blown away by this. And then the second element was that as I dove a little deeper into this world, I was just also fascinated by its history and its culture and its political dynamism. And so it was pretty clear at a certain point that if I wanted to finish graduate school, I should probably switch topics.
And so I wanted, this is not normally a question I get to immediately, but I think it's so unusual because so many people we have on the show and, you know, traditional work of authorship, you're not entering a community. But I think before we even get into the follow-up question, which is why you wrote the book, to get to that issue up front, tell us, broadly speaking, we'll get into more details, what you did in order to put this book together, because it really is something.
So I did what most anthropologists do, which is spend a heck of a lot of time with the either community or, you know, institution or phenomena that you're studying. And in my case, I decided just to go somewhere where there were a lot of geeks and hackers, and that was San Francisco. I spent some time in Amsterdam as well, and, of course, a lot of time on the internet, too. And basically, I, you know, my life revolved around free software and digital activism for a number of years. And it spanned from volunteering at the Electronic Frontier Foundation, which I thought would be a good way to kind of get an insider view of sort of activism around censorship and civil liberties, and I thought the EFF address would also help me quite a bit when emailing geeks and hackers. I live with them. I spent an enormous amount of time online following one project, Debian, which is a large free software project, very closely. I traveled quite a bit to hacker conferences and developer conferences as well.
So, to be clear, your background is not as a geek or a hacker or a technologist, correct?
No. I mean, I was a bit of a nerd in middle school and high school, but that's the extent of it.
So it's kind of what I call myself. My undergrad degree is in industrial labor relations. I messed around with the Commodore 64, but I'm basically a wannabe geek. And I think it sounds like whether you're wannabe or not, but certainly the not clear geek, in that sense.
No, I didn't own my first computer until I was 21.
See, there you go. And maybe that, you know, and I guess, you know, those perhaps are relatively fresh eyes on this community. So, why write the book itself? What need or what interest or what hole, if you will, are you trying to fill, in the literature about this, about hacking more broadly and then perhaps the community itself?
Right. Well, of course, I have to say that, you know, for tenure, you have to write the book. But even if that wasn't, you know, such a pragmatic issue at hand, you know, I did feel and do feel that the book has filled in various holes in the literature on intellectual property and geeks and hackers. And it does so in a couple of ways. Okay, so there actually has been an explosive literature on IP and challenges to copyrights and patents, especially to come out of the legal world with writers such as Lawrence Lessig and Yochai Benkler, right? And Julie Cohen and many others. And a lot of it is excellent work. But what doesn't come across in that work is, I think, what my book fulfills. And this is, you know, a bit of the history behind the motivation to contest intellectual property, a kind of very close, granular look at the very aesthetics and practices of programming, which is the basis for what I call productive freedom, where hackers insist that they should have free rein to hack freely. It gives a very, very close look at particular legal battles over things like illegal code under the Digital Millennium Copyright Act. And so it gives a, you know, very deep ethnographic sensibility of this world, related to intellectual property. I think on the other side, what it also does is start to give a different picture of the world of computer hacking. And there's been actually a lot less written about computer hackers. There's a handful of very good books as well. But really, this is a world that has been untouched, overlooked, or really misunderstood and distorted. And one of the fascinating things about writing about free and open source software hacking is that while on the one hand, I think I'm very clear about what these hackers are committed to, which is, you know, access, especially when it comes to software, They tend to be kind of obsessed about computers. There's a kind of craftiness to their technical practices. There's a lot more to hacking than just open source, and I gesture at it in my book, but it's not about all hackers at all. There's just too much going on to even fit it in one book.
So you've narrowed down your topic perhaps to this subset within the hacking community. Perhaps you could give us, before I ask you to define some terms, a broad, if you will, demographic sketch of the community. And I think it's relevant to what we're going to talk about, but also to give people a sense up front. You know, as you mentioned, there are stereotypes of the hacker, quote unquote. What did you experience? If you were to describe literally basic data, what does it look like?
Okay, so for the open source hacker or just hackers in general?
Let's use your subset to start.
So open source. Okay, well, definitely male. A lot more guys, way more than females. I would say their backgrounds tend to be most people I interviewed come from middle class or lower middle class families. With decent educations, although many, many people I interviewed decided either to drop out of college or never finish as well, in part because you can get a good job without that degree. I would say when it comes to, let's just say, psychology, there's often this propensity to characterize the geek as being, you know, asocial or difficult. And that, I think, is pretty off. I saw all personality types in the open source world and people, you know, with all sorts of outside interest to hacking. You know, people who were so obsessed that, you know, that's all they did, to people who were also avid snowboarders at the same time. Really kind of diverse when it comes to their psychologies. I would say also in terms of open source, the national background is quite diverse as well. You know, I concentrated primarily on North America and Europe, but because I studied Debian, which again is this very large free software project, there's developers from all over the world, from Costa Rica, from Brazil, from Argentina, from Vietnam, from Japan. And so there's a real sort of international bent to the open source community as well. And I think that's an important factor. And again, they tend to be, you know, people who are, you know, if not swimming in the dough, economically well off because of their profession.
Now, you mentioned it, you used a couple of words there, and I think many listeners are going to be familiar with them, but for the uninitiated, give me a broad definition of how you define hacker, because that term has been is somewhat controversial. There are some scholars who have written that the term itself is pejorative or is read in a pejorative way, this, you know, the concept of a hacker being a criminal. So if you would give your definition of a hacker, and then also, just again for the uninitiated, what is coding, which of course is the title of your book?
So a hacker, when it comes to computers, I would say are computer aficionados. They're really kind of focused in on the craft of computers, and they tend to be committed to a cluster of values such as free speech and privacy are two of the kind of most common ones. Aside from that, you know, there's actually a lot of differences among hackers as well. So some of them are programmers, and when I refer to coding, that means people who are coding software and source code, or, you know, is the underlying directions of software. A hacker can also be a system or net administrator who maintains servers, or they can be security researchers who are really thinking about how to best secure a system. Now, one thing that I will often say about what hackers share, because there are differences, there's, you know, key ethical differences in terms of whether a hacker breaks the law or not. So open source tends to be a community that stays within the bounds of the law. They've reinvented the law. There's also a more transgressive hacker tradition, where a lot of individuals have broken the law. I wouldn't necessarily say they're criminals, but they've certainly broken the law as they explore technical systems. Now, one thing that maybe all hackers share is this tight convergence of what I called craft and craftiness. To be a good hacker, you really have to be technically adept in your, you know, technical art or craft. And this, again, could be programming, it could be security research, it could be administering a server. And it takes decades and decades of constant learning to stay on top of your game and to be technically sophisticated. These are real sort of people who are technically adept. And to be a good hacker means to be a good craftsperson. On the other hand, to be a good hacker often means to be thinking outside of the box and not accept any rule as given. And this can be very handy in a technical sense. There is a problem that must be solved, and so you do it in a hackish way, which means an ingenious, clever, counterintuitive way. It also means that you may be focused in on breaking security as a way to improve security, but you're always thinking about how to bypass that barrier. And then that craftiness, while it's often channeled towards technical understanding or technical improvement, is also channeled politically. And so one of the fascinating things about open source as a political world is that there was a legal system in place for patents and copyrights, and Richard Stallman, who is the founder of the Free Software Foundation and the idea, the concept of free software, you know, treated the legal system as a hacker, which was a system that could be undermined and improved with a new system, and that's precisely what he did.
We're chatting with Gabriella Coleman of McGill University, author of the book Coding Freedom, The Ethics and Aesthetics of Hacking, on KCSU-FM Stanford and Hearsay Culture. Gabriella, before we get into some of these issues in a little more detail, I do want to ask you about your subtitle. So, The Ethics and Aesthetics of Hacking. So I'm not going to ask you what are the ethics and aesthetics, because that, of course, would be the remainder of the interview. So I'll merely ask you again, and this is what happens when you get interviewed by an academic, what do you mean by those two words? What are ethics? And again, that I know it could be the rest of the interview as well. So if you could give me a short definition of what you mean by ethics and aesthetics, that would be helpful as we contextualize the discussion.
Sure. So ethics, in the context of the book, means a couple of things, one of which is a commitment to free speech, a commitment to open access. And I look at the legal and institutional mechanisms by which these free software developers have come to embody this free speech ethic. So it pertains to things like licensing, but it also pertains to the institution of the free software project, which is modeled on ideas of transparency and access. And these are very complicated institutions, actually. So that's where the kind of analysis of ethics enters into the discussion. The aesthetics has to do with their technical practice of sort of creative ingenuity and how that comes about in how they write code and how they interact with each other. And there's a tremendous premium put on cleverness, individuality, and ingenuity. And I track the ways in which this emerges in things like coding, software development, but also in practices around humor, because humor is a great vehicle for expressing your ingenuity, and it occurs in very social places such as the conference when people are giving talks, but is also embedded in their software as well, where they'll put jokes in their software, and they're called Easter eggs. So I do quite a bit of analysis around their aesthetic practices.
So let me get serious, very serious here for a moment, because and over the last few weeks, particularly a couple of weeks ago, news came out of the suicide of Aaron Swartz. and the tragedy around, you know, his death and what may have been, the external circumstances that, that contributed, to the awful choice that he made. Did you have contact with Swartz? And even if you didn't, what's your take on him and his legacy given your immersion, in the hacking community? And incidentally, perhaps the initial question is, was Swartz a hacker?
So I did come across him, actually, while I was writing up my dissertation in Chicago. He and I think, met for dinner. Someone put us in contact because, you know, someone's like, oh, you've got to meet this Aaron Swartz kid. He's really committed to free software and open access and is very precocious and young and intelligent. And so I met him then. He read my entire dissertation a couple years later. And then, you know, we definitely ran into each other socially quite a bit. And he's so interesting because he absolutely is, I would say, a hacker. He called himself a hacker. He was part of this free software community of people who call themselves hackers. He was really actually committed in such an explicit, consistent way to the politics of information freedom. But what was also interesting about him was that while he wrote code, he engaged in, I would say, political activities around information access, he also was marshaling his technical and legal expertise to engage in political activity that went beyond questions of information freedom and hackers as well. He was much more generally interested in questions of social justice too. And in this way, he's not completely unique. There's definitely a cohort of hackers in this vein. They tend to be slightly smaller, but also growing as well. I think in particular, not only his passing, but the conditions under which it happened, where he was under, you know, he was about to go on trial, and he faced the heavy hand of the Computer Fraud and Abuse Act for basically, you know, liberating, or he didn't actually ever liberate the articles, but he had downloaded a large number of articles from an academic database and was, you know, perhaps going to release them to the world, I think really struck the community very, very deeply, in part because many could identify with what he was doing and were also taken aback by the kind of extremity of the punishments he faced.
You know, and again, the circumstances being such as they were, I'm compelled to ask you, what, and perhaps this is a question for the end of our interview, but I think it's appropriate now. What do you think is the legacy of Swartz? And I don't mean that broadly. I mean the impact from your perspective on his colleagues, other hackers, other people that he came across. I mean, again, I'm not asking you to use a crystal ball as much as really turn to your understanding of the community, its ethics and aesthetics as you identify them. What do you think the impact is going to be of the passing of Aaron Swartz?
So this is maybe a good time to return to these like geek stereotypes that, you know, these hackers and geeks are very asocial.
Yes.
Set of individuals. And again, that's, you know, completely false. And I think Aaron's passing showed just how deep the social ties go. And this just was so evident with the outpouring, with the services. You know, that this world is one which is about remaking and making technology, about thinking in interesting ways about the politics of access, but it's also about deep social relationships, and that came out so clearly. And I just wanted to sort of mention that because I think, again, there's this really persistent stereotype that I think really needs to be addressed. So what's been fascinating about the, you know, aftermath, in a kind of very specific way, is that there is this intense energy to actually do something about the Computer Fraud and Abuse Act, which was passed in the United States in 1986, and it deals with computer intrusions. And as many legal scholars have noted, it's extremely broad and extremely vague. Mm-hmm. And even those who do believe in the statutes, such as Orrin Kerr, tend to even recognize that there's some core problems. And there have been an amazing number, or just, you know, two or three, but very, very directed number of initiatives to do something about it. And so one is Fork the Law, for example, which has been started by a number of hackers, and they're asking for comments about how to change it. There's initiatives being spearheaded by folks at Stanford under Jennifer Granick and the EFF, and Demand Progress, which was a nonprofit that Aaron helped charter, is also really quite involved. And it's a David, a Goliath, to try to change it, you know? And the hackers and the groups involved feel like the David, but I think that there have been other instances in the history of kind of the politics of hacking where the David has kind of surmounted the Goliath, and this might be one interesting case in which they're successful in reforming the law.
So you mentioned Jennifer Granick, Gabrielle, and a few other people, and I do want to get to that. You know, I teach the Computer Fraud and Abuse Act, the CFAA, which is the federal analog to the common law cause of action, as you know, called trespass to chattels. And you know, one of the interesting procedural or substantive issues that exists in the CFAA is a simple matter that the amount of damages that you need to prove in order to meet the claim is ridiculously low. And that gets to, you know, some of the reform issues that I want to talk about, in particular with regard to this demographic question, which we're going to pick up right after I say that you are listening to KZSU-FM Stanford and Hearsay Culture. For those of you that listen regularly, you know that KZSU is a nonprofit, non-commercial radio station at Stanford University that requires donations from listeners like you to continue its diverse programming. You have a couple of ways you can make a donation to KZSU. You can email our underwriting department at underwriting@kzsu.stanford.edu, or you can click on Donate to KZSU at our webpage, and anyone will be happy to get back to you if you choose to make a donation. Now, regardless, I do hope that you continue listening to the station and to Hearsay Culture. This demographic question, Gabriella, that you mentioned is an important one, because, and I do want to dig deeper there, because, and as you mentioned, it's something that's particularly important to you as an author and someone who studied the community. There is undoubtedly the persistent image of the Matthew Broderick type character from War Games, the, you know, somewhat geeky adolescent man, as the prototype of the hacker. And me, I'd go even further, although you tell me if you disagree, the prototype of the person interested in computers. What, in terms of the role of women, I want to get there in a moment, but, you know, you said at least the sub-community in open source was predominantly men. Perhaps you could speak, if you can, more broadly to the hacking community more generally. What's your sense of the not only the numbers of women's, but even the place of women in these communities?
So it's the million-dollar question that has some answers, some straightforward answers, some very difficult answers, and some arenas where we don't have answers. It is predominantly male, and on a kind of very at some level, it just reflects general trends that exist in society at large. So computer science majors for females reached their peak in 1985. In many of the science, technology, engineering, and math fields, STEM, we have, if not total parity, the numbers have just gotten astronomically better in undergraduate education, and computer science is the one field that has not at all. Hmm. It is stagnant, it is low, and I will say until those numbers change, you're never, never going to see any change in a kind of subcultural field that is very volunteer-oriented, right? And so that's a huge issue. I'm not really going to talk about, you know, what's going on in society at large, though I think it is important to discuss that. Mm-hmm. I think in open source, one of the fascinating things is that in the last 5 years, a burgeoning, or I would say explosive conversation about this very issue, which has led to the initiation of all sorts of projects such as Debian Woman, the diversity list for Python, which is a programming language, anti-harassment statements for all sorts of hacker conferences such as the Computer Chaos Club, right? There's been a recognition that there's such a problem that the community has moved towards trying to remedy it in certain ways, right? It hasn't been entirely successful. And also there is definitely some dynamics among, you know, male developers that some people would say is, you know, particularly masculine or macho or aggressive and can be off-putting to women. But I will say that, again, in a lot of the open source projects, you know, you do have, on the one hand, a very strong drive towards kind of elitism and displaying your intelligence and affirming a kind of commitment to individualism and learning on your own. On the other hand, you also have pretty accentuated practices of, you know, mentoring, sharing, and helping as well. And these two coexist in these projects. It's something I actually spend quite a bit of time writing about in my book. And it's one of the reasons why I think these initiatives to increase diversity have, on the one hand, you know, been accepted and have definitely improved things. On the other hand, there's, you know, a long way to go as well.
Well, I respect the fact that you don't want to opine more broadly on society, but I will press you, since you referred to it, to offer any theories you have as to why this continues to exist. And I, as I said to you off air, and I'll say on air, as someone that teaches internet law, I've always been, and I've taught it for now for 6 years, it has always been exceptionally difficult to get women to sign up for the classes. Now, you could easily say, well, maybe it's because of you, Professor, but so far, it's not clear to me at all that that's the case. In fact, I don't think that that's the issue, and I've been very candid with myself, not in a Woody Allen-ish sense, but in a real sense, to ask myself, am I doing something here? What is your... If you have any operative theories, what are they, even with regard to this subset, which I think would be illuminating more generally?
You mean society at large?
Well, no, I mean literally, what are your theories? I think, in other words, let me ask the question differently and more clearly. What are your theories as to why this continues to persist within the subset of the open source community? And I was just saying, as an aside, though, those insights that I'm going to ask you to address them may be useful more broadly.
I mean, I think you do need to equalize the numbers more broadly before you're ever going to have anything close to parity in open source. And we're not even close to society at large, so there's no way that it can happen within the open source world at all. I also think, you know, it is worth looking at. You know, there was a really interesting study. This is a little bit off topic, but I think related, among professors. And married professors, female professors, don't succeed as much as male professors who are married, especially if they're married to a non-academic. And it still seems to be the case that, you know, women are stuck with more domestic duties as well. You know, and this is going to impact volunteer arenas in some, you know, pretty profound ways. So that could be another element at play. I do think another factor has to do with the fact that, as I had mentioned, hackers tend to be very technologically adept. Most of the people I interviewed started programming or tinkering with computers at the age of like 8, oftentimes as young as 3. Whereas most of the women, with the exception of 2 that I interviewed, did not learn how to start programming until they went to college. And it's that gap also that makes a huge difference. you know, you enter these worlds and there can definitely be intimidation. Wow, you know, everyone is so much more advanced. And again, while there's sort of mentoring that happens, that's a heck of a lot of mentoring to have to have happened or to, you know, catch up with. But there's something going on in these communities, and actually Wikipedia is probably the best example of this. It's a community that is not technically based, and it's still predominantly men, mm-hmm. right? And there is definitely something about modes and styles of interacting online where even if the community at large is very nice and very affable, if you just get a handful of people who are kind of loud and trollish and aggressive, that can be extremely, you know, off-putting. And these kind of women-only spaces or spaces that are meant to kind of nurture diversity have helped enormously increasing numbers in the face of online interactions, which can often, you know, devolve into kind of very loud, aggressive fights.
Yeah, it's interesting to see this, and you know, because as someone that writes in the intellectual property law field, you can see a pretty stark divide, although it's changing slowly, between and I hate these phrases, but they're used, and I think they're used partially because they reflect these differences. The differences between soft IP and hard IP, and soft IP is generally thought or is used to refer to copyright and trademark, whereas hard IP refers to patents, and then trade secrecy, which is what I write about, is forgotten. But that's a side issue that more has to do with trade secret law than anything else. But it is definitely the case that there are not as many women writing in this quote unquote hard IP area. And putting aside, you know, whether the terms themselves are in any way dismissive or pejorative, and there are people in the community who on both sides who think they are, it is still noteworthy when women write on patents, and yet that's happening slowly with more frequency, so that while I can't say that my sense is that the IP scholar community is even with regard to patents, without question on the copyright and trademark side, you don't see those gender differences. Without digging deep into IP, I'm curious what your reaction is to that. Is there any parallel between, assuming I'm right, this disparity on the patent side and what you've seen in the community?
In the open source community?
Yes.
Yeah, no, that's really interesting. It is definitely the case that, you know, women have gotten involved in open source projects, and, you know, they've tended, some of the projects that have most female participation are projects like Drupal, which is a content management system, and less in projects like the Linux kernel. The kernel being the kind of liaison between hardware and software, and which is seen as like an uber technical project as well. And again, it may reflect this kind of difference in when you were trained. It's also the case that I've heard in some cases where women who were, you know, technically involved and inclined are then slotted into kind of communication and media work. You know, much to their chagrin, as well. And that's a dynamic that I've heard in a number of instances that does happen as well in some of these projects.
We're chatting with Gabrielle Coleman, author of the book Coding Freedom, The Ethics and Aesthetics of Hacking, on KZSU-FM Stanford and Hearsay Culture. Gabrielle, there's so much to talk about here, but I do want to cover a few other topics in the remaining 15 or so minutes that we have, and we're getting close to what I call the unfair portion of the show, where I ask you questions that you can't answer appropriately in the time that you have left. But then I ask the questions anyway. So let me turn to a couple of other related topics. There's an interesting thread that you have running through the book, which is one that I certainly didn't anticipate reading it, involving transparency. And you relate it, and by transparency here, we're referring to the transparency of again, this subset of hackers and whether they felt or feel the need to discuss and describe what they're doing to a broader community. And I was curious about this because you tell two tales themselves, which I think are useful, on, or at least offer insights. On one side, you have this notion within the community itself of making visible what you say, the emerging or continuous dilemmas that are faced. And yet, you relate a story involving an interaction between a group of coders where there was a debate among this group as to whether they should be discussing what they're doing with the outside and explaining it, by the outside meaning even other coders, but who aren't part of this community. And one individual, who of course, like many people in this community, are using a handle, says that he doesn't think there's a need to educate every, quote, random Joe six-pack about what they're working on. So I'm curious, because I hadn't anticipated this as an issue, is there a transparency thread that dominates within this community? And more broadly, what is the role of transparency as part of these ethics and aesthetics of hacking?
Yeah, great question. So open source and free software is really committed to this idea of transparency, which is very different from, you know, anonymous, kind of another entity I study with a lot of hackers, which is anything but transparency. And, you know, it shapes, everything from how they interact, one-on-one. So for example, there's a key signing protocol, and I'm not going to get it. It's fairly technical, but you know, these geeks and hackers like to use encryption and verification protocols. And in order to verify other individuals, you will do this procedure where you sign each other's keys and show each other your nationally issued ID. You know, it's like, this is who I am. We have to verify each other, and you can't even join the project until you do that. Or, you know, at the more institutional level, Debian, for example, all their mailing lists except for one are completely open. Anyone can read them. They're archived. They're there on the internet. All the discussions are supposed to happen in public. And there's one private mailing list, which is simply to kind of announce if you're going on vacation so that you don't need to make that public to the world. Of course, there's discussions that do happen, important ones, that do happen on this list, and there's big debate as to whether that's appropriate or not. At the same time, there's a kind of recognition that this is a very kind of technical world as well, and while their methods and techniques for transparency and access can be read and understood by technical people, you know, to then jump that extra mile or go that extra mile and have it be fully understandable to the world at large requires even more translation, you know? And I would say that, you know, there's limits to that, but there's also a lot of instances where these projects have moved to making themselves, you know, understandable and translatable to the world at large as well.
We're chatting with Gabriella Coleman, author of the book Coding Freedom, The Ethics and Aesthetics of Hacking, on KZSU-FM Stanford and Hearsay Culture. A few more questions for you, Gabriella. With regard to the question, the question's the wrong word, although maybe it is. There are two dominant players, one directly and really the founder of the movement, another who's influenced it. Let's start with Richard Stallman. You know, Richard Stallman is, you know, clearly recognized as the founder of the open source movement, as it were. He is a certainly well-known figure. He's also a controversial one. You talk about him in the book, as I think you'd have to in getting into this community. And I'm curious to get your perspectives on Stallman, not just as an anthropologist, but also based upon the conversations and interactions that you had, not just perhaps with him, but with other hackers. What is his place today in the open source community as you see it?
So, well, first of all, he would not be happy, you know, having you refer to it as open source.
Yes, I understand that.
I mean, and that's a good way to kind of introduce him. Yep. You know, he is very much known for his the kind of purity of his ideals, his conviction, and his consistency. And I would say that even people who are not a fan of his communication style, again, he will, you know, always call out when you're using open source or, you know, in my case, he was very unhappy that I used the term intellectual property because he doesn't like it because it collapses on like things, you know. He's going to speak his mind and be very consistent about his beliefs. And this really rubs people the wrong way or they don't agree with it. But I would say most people recognize just how important his role was in this movement and how his kind of almost crazy utopian ideal, which was to create this like software commune, and was based, you know, initially just on writing free software and only later used legal mechanisms to do so, was incredibly important for laying the groundwork for the kind of explosion of free and open source software later. And in the book, you know, I try to, on the one hand, give credit and acknowledge his really important role. And as an anthropologist, you tend to focus more on social practice than on individuals. And yet his role is just so undeniable in many ways. And yet on the other hand, when it comes to the kind of explosion and spread of open source, it was also based on a kind of freewheeling form of collaboration that later became more institutionalized. And it was a style of collaboration that Linus Torvalds really helped to kind of innovate and perfect. It was not Richard Stallman who did that. And any kind of vibrant social movements, in this case, this is not so much a political movement. I mean, it's political, but, because it has political ramifications, but not organized politically. But any kind of techno-social movement is going to have different, contributions from different individuals, and from different sources. So his is definitely recognized. He's really, I think, respected. On the other hand, people recognize that there have been other actors, both technical and individuals, you know, the role of Unix, the role of Linus, that were incredibly, incredibly important for ensuring the kind of vibrancy and explosive growth of open source.
We have a few more minutes left, and I do want to ask you kind of one specific question and one broad one. So, you know, as someone who, like I said, is not a coder personally, but who knows coders and who's been around technology policy, I read this book with a keen interest, not just because it's occasionally interesting to, you know, read insights about, as you mentioned, people you may know, but also to, you know, to address some of the questions we raise here. But I'm curious because this book, I don't think, is clearly not written for me per se, as much as it is for a broader audience. For those that aren't as familiar with the open source or hacking community, what would you want them to take away from this book? I mean, in terms of if there is a message beyond the study of the community itself, is there a broader theme or idea that you'd want a reader to take away as they learn about this community?
Yes, yeah. I think one really important lesson, idea that comes out of this is that, first of all, the internet and collaboration is the basis for new institutions. There's sort of this idea that the internet equals decentralized production, and that certainly is the case, and we have many examples of it, but we also have really interesting examples of institutional production. And by institution, I don't mean, you know, the post office or the corporation. But these hackers, and they're not the only ones, there's other examples, have built a really fascinating institution for collaborating. And I think this is just important because I think the mainstream message is internet equals decentralized peer production. I think that exists, but it exists amidst other forms. And then I would say, you know, not related to this, but still very, very important, is, you know, to think about the fact that the internet is, you know, tends to be aligned with certain ideals around free speech, and internet freedoms. And, you know, these are under threat all the time. And I do think geeks and hackers are really, really important cohort of actors who are actually working in very interesting political and legal ways to try to ensure that civil liberties stay alive online.
Last question for you. Next projects. I mean, this obviously consumed years of your life. The book is only recently out, but of course we know that the fact that the book is on the shelves means that it's, you know, it's been done, quote unquote, for at least you know, a few months. What are you working on now? What's your next focus? Are you staying with the geek community, or have you moved on to other topics?
No, I've moved on to Anonymous, which is known to engage in all sorts of protest actions, to do things like defend internet freedoms, but also provide technological assistance in the Middle East, and also engage in much more dicey direct action forms of hacking to leak information about corruption. And they're a really fascinating entity to study because they do actually do not want to become institutionalized. And they're also a domain that has brought together hackers who are really important for running infrastructure and for spearheading the technical operations. But it's a domain that is far more open than, let's just say, open source, because people with no technical skills get involved in anonymous operations. And so it's much more populist and participatory, and also uses the kind of rich visual vocabulary that the internet can offer with videos and internet images. And that is what has also consumed, but I mean consumed, my life for years and years, because they're actually very difficult to study because they can't be transparent and accessible in the way that open source is, in part because they're committed to this idea of anonymity, and also because a portion of them break the law and, well, you've got to be clandestine as a result. So it's been really, really hard to study them in comparison to open source, which was really kind of like a piece of cake. Very, you know, enjoyable and took a lot of work, but not difficult in a methodological sense.
Well, I will look forward to your work, your published work in that area, and I'll give you the invitation now to come back on the show to discuss that work when you are ready and when you have enough data points to discuss that you can discuss publicly. Gabriella Coleman, author of the book Coding Freedom, The Ethics and Aesthetics of Hacking, thank you so much for joining us on Hearsay Culture. It's a fascinating book. I really enjoyed reading it and thinking about, you know, these questions of what this community is and what it could be. Thank you so much for joining us today on the show.
You're welcome.
I'm excited to mention a number of guests coming up on in this quarter on Hearsay Culture's schedule. Among the guests, Professor Vance Ricks of Guilford College on the role of gossip in social media. Ellen Broad, Executive Officer of the Australian Digital Alliance, will be on. Dan Trottier, postdoctoral fellow at Uppsala University, author of Social Media as Surveillance. Ron Epstein, CEO of Epicenter IP Group on patent non-practicing entities, also known as patent trolls, and there are a couple of loaded terms for you. Professor Anne Balsamo of USC Annenberg School of Communication, author of Designing Culture, The Technological Imagination at Work. Dave Soibert, head of the University of California Santa Barbara's Cylinder Digitization and Preservation Project. Upcoming guests, meaning, or future guests, I should say, guests that will be on later in the year include Professor Patrick Lynn of California Polytechnic State University, Susan Chalmers, a policy lead of Internet New Zealand, as well as Marvin Amori, and a few other guests that I am currently working on, at least lining up for recording later in the year. So I'm very excited by this slate of guests, and of course I always welcome your comments and suggestions as to guests that I should have on by emailing me at dave@hearsayculture.com. In fact, a listener emailed me recently with a suggestion, and I'm pleased to say that that suggestion has been followed, and the individual that was suggested will be on the show. You have a number of ways you can listen to Hearsay Culture. You can listen live on KZSU-FM Stanford Thursday mornings at 9 a.m. Pacific time. You can also stream it if you're not in the Bay Area at kzsulive.stanford.edu. You can also listen to the show via podcast. There are several ways to get the podcast. You can get it by going to the Stanford Center for Internet Society's webpage at cyberlaw.stanford.edu. You can subscribe to our podcast feed through the Apple's iTunes store, although it is free, where not only will you get Hearsay Culture, but you'll get all events occurring at CIS. And lastly, you can go to hearsayculture.com, where you can get all 170 previous shows, as well as the upcoming schedule. At this point, and the nature of things, I don't blog on the page at all, really. Occasionally I will do writing in Slate and other media venues, but I use Hearsay Culture at this point solely to for the show and to promote it. So, again, I welcome your comments, suggestions, and feedback at dave@hearsayculture.com. Thank you much for joining us today. I hope you enjoyed the conversation. Please stay tuned to KZSU for more diverse programming, and have a great day.